Hey, Brendan.
Hello, Alan.
Oh,
Hello,
hey.
gentlemen.
Hey, Jürgen, you're there too? How
Hey.
great.
I'm over here in the corner. You guys have, you designed this podcast around a table for two, so it's only fair that since I am the new member, that I sit over in the corner at the kids' table.
I just want to make sure you know your place,
It's as it should be, as it should be.
Jürgen. I'm kidding.
I think it's funny that we only ever really had a table for like
A month?
two yeah, like 3 or 4 episodes, not that many. And then it was virtually a table because we've always been recording into multiple places. It's something that I forget when I'm talking about the show to other people, and I'm like, oh yeah, my other co-hosts aren't even in the same room with me. And then they're like, wow, it's amazing. If you think it's
Technology.
yeah, if you think it's amazing, we'd love to hear about it. We haven't heard, I haven't heard from a lot of listeners recently. We're getting a few likes on the Facebook page, which is great. Shares are better if you're in that, according to the internet anyway. But I have been looking at the stats a little bit, and it is creeping up. It's nice. We're actually getting some kind of listener traction again. It's fun.
It's amazing what happens when you actually put out content.
Magnificent.
Well, we're putting out episode 225 this week of the Not a Thing podcast. You can find all of our podcasts at notathingpodcast.com, where we'll link every show and all sorts of show notes. We have a lot to talk about this episode. We're starting off. I think Jürgen, did you call it this week in MoviePass news? I feel like we've had a MoviePass related story like every episode for a little while. It's almost as bad as when we were talking about drones.
Well, they walked back, so we gotta walk back.
Yeah. So what's happening is MoviePass, if you haven't been following the story, MoviePass's CEO sometime last week issued a whoops, or a mea culpa if you're into Latin, and said that his statements at a like kind of industry convention, where he said that MoviePass was gonna track all of our data and they knew where people like came from and then went to after seeing movies and had so many opportunities to use this data, they kind of walked that back and said, oh, we actually never were tracking that information. And in fact, we're removing all of those kinds of tracking abilities in the current app. So I'm like, how, if they weren't there, what are you removing is my question. But I don't know. We don't want to cast too many aspersions against them, but we do want to be fair about it, because I think we've mentioned MoviePass a fair amount with respect to our kind of movie watching habits. And you know, it's all full disclosure. I mean, assuming you believe their disclosure.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with yes. I mean, we talked about it last time about how we all had the app in like don't use the location unless the app is actually running. So again, assuming we believe that the app is only using it when it's running, it should work correctly. That being said, I think the immediacy of the CEO's kind of apology kind of speaks to how interested people are about it from a an inf you know privacy rights kind of perspective. And I think it shows that power of like people's kind of understanding of things is getting a little stronger. Otherwise, I think the CEO would have just been like, yeah, whatever. I mean, we're doing it. So I think that bodes well for how kind of personal privacy goes, at least digitally anyway. That's something that we've talked about a lot on the show, and we want to keep kind of in the forefront of things. Kind of in that vein as well, another kind of common topic on the show is net neutrality and how it is a thing. At least it still is a thing for now. We're hoping that the FCC doesn't completely screw us over in messing with the rules of net neutrality. But interestingly, a number of states have put together their own net neutrality protection bills. I believe in Washington state, they've even already passed one to kind of maintain some of the net neutrality aspects of the internet, specifically in Washington state. And California, where the three of us live, so yay California, just put together a bill that that says similar kind of information. Some people that have read the bill have said that it pretty much just takes the provisions that were handed down in 2015 around net neutrality at a national level and then kind of codifies them into law at the state level. This is kind of interesting because the proposed kind of changes supposedly also say that the states can't override the federal kind of understanding of this. And I think that's probably ripe for a lawsuit somewhere. Mm-hmm. And being from California, it's pretty much going to happen. The lawsuit part, I mean, where, you know, it tends to get kind of litigious around here sometimes. But I think on this side of it, it ends up really, like I said, codifying those net neutrality protections. And then it actually goes one step further, because the big thing about the net neutrality provisions were about there's no pay to access fee. You can't discriminate as an ISP against, like, essentially any content provider's sources. That was the big thing that I believe it was Netflix was kind of pointing out, was that they pay a higher amount of bill because of their you know, the prolificness of the bandwidth that they use, and that was something that, you know, they had to do that because you have to, if in order to compete, you have to pay. So it's pay to play, essentially. They also introduced some protections around that. But then the big thing about the California bill is that it makes zero rating of bandwidth caps illegal. Are you familiar with this? I actually had to look this up because I hadn't heard of this. That some ISPs have bandwidth caps, or most ISPs have bandwidth caps based on all their kind of data plans for different things. I know I have one for my, you know, my cell phone, things like that. But what they said was the bandwidth caps from some ISPs are they will zero rate certain apps or certain sources. So I there's some ISPs that say, like, okay, you can watch any kind of video streaming and it won't count against your bandwidth cap. So that's the zero rating. It's not, it's counting, it's saying that certain traffic doesn't count against your bandwidth cap. And so people are like, oh, wow, great. I will use and, you know, pick this ISP or this phone provider because I can watch whatever I want and it doesn't hurt my bandwidth cap. What it results in is it makes you automatically prefer whatever those sources are because it's not going to count against your cap. And right. So the bill has said that any amount of zero rating cannot be done on a per app nor per source basis. So what that effectively says is you can either have bandwidth caps and everybody gets the same cap kind of level, or you can get rid of bandwidth caps. Which
or the California bill did allow for some zero rating.
Yeah.
But it's you have to apply it to any app of the same kind of service.
Right.
So if, like, AT&T says anything streaming on Pandora is exempt, they also would have to let Spotify go as well. Or any other streaming music program.
Which I think is interesting, except that means that they have to be able to tell that's streaming music.
Right.
Like, for example, I have a music streaming thing from my home server. I have I use Subsonic to just put all my music onto a place so I can stream it from my car or whatnot. And unless they're examining traffic, you
which
can't
they
tell,
are
yeah unless you're
obviously
unless you're examining traffic, you can't obviously tell what, or you can't tell what kind of traffic is being moved. And so does that mean that my music streaming would be zero rated as well because it's personal streaming? I think that adds an interesting wrinkle. But
does that also apply to yourself if you're streaming from your house to your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going over, you're getting tracked on your cell phone carrier, but not necessarily from your home ISP?
Yeah, I mean, most, at least that I've seen, I don't think I've seen any ISPs that cap, from a bandwidth perspective, uploads. It's almost always shown as a download cap, like this amount of bandwidth down. I mean, I haven't looked that closely at it, but I bet that I'm only capped on the phone side for pulling it down.
Mm.
But
well, I know who your ISP is for your house, and I know that there's no caps.
Wow, you know too much about me, maybe, Brendan.
Nice.
We've been friends for a long time. I know things.
That's true. That's true. This podcast has been going on for a long time, and we've been friends longer than that. So it's good information. It's good information.
Yeah, I only found out about caps last fall.
Did you find out the hard way?
Yes. It had never really been relevant for us until I restructured my home movie collection with Dropbox. So I ended up uploading and downloading a ton of gigabytes, and I changed my mind midway through the process. And suddenly we get a letter with like, you are now being fined $10 for exceeding your limit. And I had never even heard of the cap before, so I was enraged.
Rightly so. It's ridiculous. It doesn't cost them any more money.
No.
You mean those little pulses of light don't cost, you know, when they go down that glass fiber between?
It's just a way to make more money, which I, of course, do not approve of.
Well, we also approve of the internet as being as close to a human right as possible.
Yep.
I think that direction has been moving. And I feel like I've even heard ads for, you know, major like AT&T and other major providers talking about the power of the internet, and it's so shady how behind the scenes they're like, oh, it has the power to connect us and drive the future, and it's like, oh, and also line our pockets, by the way.
It has the power to make us so rich, right? And take more advantage of people. That is possibly its biggest power.
Yes. Yes, so we're looking at that. We're watching those. Interestingly, the federal kinds of changes have not come down yet, so that repeal has not really gone into effect. I think if this law can get passed before that goes, there's some ability to say, you know, from a precedence point of view, because it naturally turns into a kind of federalism argument, like when is it a protection that's issued by, you know, the federal government versus something that is issued by the state, and when they're in conflict, who wins?
Yeah, it seems like all those states' rights people should be on board with all this.
You would think. One would think. Hmm. Mm. Well, moving from kind of neutrality or net neutrality in the United States, we have a net neutrality story, sort of. Coming from a different part of the world that might be coming to a WordPress site near you.
Maybe a WordPress site that we have. Who knows? Yeah, I'm going to take this one. Sorry, Jorgen. It's a story out of Norway.
Woo!
there's a group there that has developed a plugin for WordPress that apparently only took them 3 hours to make, and I think could have a huge impact on how we interact on the internet. What it does is it locks down a comment section for that page and has a quiz that's developed by the person who wrote the page. So you have to prove that you read the article before you can comment.
Oh, it's so good.
And understand it.
Yes.
Oh,
so this is... This was developed, if I remember the story correctly. This isn't brand new. It came out about a year ago, and it was developed by the online arm of the Norwegian National Broadcasting Association, like the BBC of Norway.
Yep.
So they have an online little think tank almost that try to do breakthrough and new things online, that really is like pushing how media can operate online to develop new modules, new ways of interacting with people. And this is a shining example of something they've launched that really, really works and really can make a difference.
I think we can all agree this is a thing, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Without a doubt.
I mean, the comments sections on the internet are usually the second circle of hell or something like that. I'm not sure of the best descriptor that that makes it kind of fairly describes it, but they're usually a lot less well written than the article. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. Well, and I remember back in the day when you'd have a comment section for a page, you know, people could post anonymously and they would say vile things, and that was just the nature of the beast. But these days, for many like news articles in particular, you have to put your name or prove, you know, some sort of identity. Like, people will put their real names and link to their Facebook pages and all this stuff. And they make these comments, and it's just so brazen and hateful. I don't get it.
Yeah, I think that aspect of it, I mean, that shows that I guess people are more kind of outspoken about what they, you know, think or don't. And at the same time, there is that kind of aspect of, if you're outspoken, then you're going to get like liked or shared or otherwise drive more engagement. So, you know, by it kind of like the way comment sections work is they generally thread higher. They will rate higher and sort higher things that are getting a lot of engagement, whether that's positive or negative. And so that aspect of it kind of rewards people from being kind of inflammatory. So not exactly. I mean, it's a proxy for discussion, like, because if there's a lot of discussion, I think that makes sense to want to sort that up to the top. But if it's a lot of discussion because people, if it's not really genuine discussion, but people just sniping at each other and being assholes on the internet, because that's what those comment sections kind of turn into, then I don't know. I don't think that's something that we should be encouraging necessarily either.
Thinking about comment sections, a lot of the comments I see on news articles are from people who are older. So it seems like a lot of their profiles, they're people, you know, over 40.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not judging all people over 40. What I wanted to ask the group is, do you think that's because those are the people who actually read news sites? And that's why those people are the people who are commenting there? Or like, if you go on YouTube, it's probably a bunch of younger people commenting. Or do you think it's that people are just interneting wrong because they're old or older?
I think it's possibly a combo. And I think we're also, I don't know. I think that there's probably a combo. I think there's a huge generational gap also in just in social discourse. I was going to say that, but I take it back before I said it. But I think they're complaining in different fora's.
Do you think as the internet ages and the people who are on the internet age with generations who have grown up with it, do you think discourse will get better?
I am, as previously publicized and well known, not an optimist about the future, so no.
Fair point.
I think the thing that we have to get over, and I think it's something that is really hard, is that kind of engagement model. And I think it is systemic in that it's in the interests of the platforms, if they're trying to make money off of views and eyeballs and clicks, to generate the most views and eyeballs and clicks, regardless of again the nature of that discourse. It's just prioritizing the engagement rather than the actual like discussion. So because you can serve more ads if people are clicking more, whereas if it's something that is an actual kind of discussion, it's the same people reading it back and forth potentially, and it's not really necessarily insightful or something that they want to highlight. I think it's the completely transient nature of how you know, most social media kinds of things are, does kind of lend itself to be like, it has to be engaged with quickly, otherwise it kind of scrolls off the page. So, so prioritizing actual discussion where people will stick around for a longer amount of time to do that is very hard. I think it's just that the systems that are up right now are all built on the same thing. And I think people are getting sick of that thing. Like Twitter style and Facebook style of things is getting kind of old hat for people. I'm noticing that more of my friends are disengaging from those kinds of discussions because they're noticing that it's not really a discussion. It's just kind of devolved into yelling matches. And so I think because I see a bigger trend towards people connecting with things to some degree, Snapchat and Instagram, where it's not necessarily a discussion-based kind of thing. It's more of that kind of lighthearted, I'm just checking in with the people that I want to check in with kind of thing.
I think this plays into the bigger picture of the future of the internet and its model, its financial feasibility and model of interaction and of social media and all of that, which is I honestly think that someone made a bad call earlier where they landed on the model of letting everything be free and then use your data and interaction for advertising sales. Mm-hmm. I think I saw Tim Berners-Lee do an interview about a week ago where he said the same thing. And so this is not my original genius thought. I think the internet would be a better place if those websites charged for the interaction and the membership and the participations, because then you would have a higher quality of interactions. And you wouldn't have this, and I mean, this is linked to something we'll talk about next week, but then you wouldn't have this whole personal information, data collection, advertising angled and based interaction model, which I think is part of the problem.
Yeah.
That's a big wheel to stop turning.
without a doubt. But I don't know if it will, but I think that's the only thing that would make it better.
Well, I think you're right. I think changing the idea of how those companies kind of make their money makes sense.
But they make so much of it.
Yeah, it will be interesting. Right, it will be interesting to see like if there's ways to kind of work with that and change it, because that is something that is fascinating to me anyway. So. Very interesting. I think what's also interesting is kind of moving in towards, but not all the way to like a primarily print-based sort. I mean, we were talking about news from kind of an internet and digitally kind of based thing, but Jürgen, you had some news from kind of an old print standby.
Yes. This week, National Geographic came out and with their new race-based issue, they have this admission on editorial level of how their coverage for decades, if not even centuries, has been racist. And they're saying that to rise above our past, we must acknowledge it. So they have a whole issue now dedicated to race. And in it, they talk about how race has been treated previously, how it's been used to help tell people apart and segregation and everything. But also they really come clean on their own coverage about how they've talked about the, you know, Aboriginal Australians being called savages who rank lowest in intelligence of all human beings, and how they've just, they've not treated race not in the way that it should have been talked about. So they're really, it's really a coming clean issue and an apology in a sense from them, which I think should be really applauded, and it's a sign of the times and all of these things. So it's a very good thing that is doing. And to me, if I take a step back and look at, so who owns National Geographic? It was bought by News Corp. about a year ago. And when News Corp, who's famous Australian owner, Rupert Murdoch, a.k.a. Not a Good Apple, bought it a year ago, I and many along with me were worried that, oh, now National Geographic is going to be used for propaganda and shitness and everything as well. And
I think we may have even talked about that on the show when that came through.
Yeah. And it hasn't. I read National Geographic through Texture, possibility for a plug here, Texture. It is one of my favorite apps. Absolutely wonderful. I'll go into detail. Pay us. And
I think
it
Apple
has...
bought Texture, so they're not going to be giving us any money anytime soon.
You're kidding. Did they?
That just happened like a week ago.
No. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember reading the article. It was like Apple buys the Netflix of magazines.
So. Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah.
As an Apple lover, I kind of also love that. That's wonderful.
I mean, if Apple wants to give us money,
yeah,
that would be fine too.
I am happy to go on at length about the AirPods, the AirBuds. The thing is, they're another awesome product. I will happily endorse. But back to National Geographic, they've really upheld their editorial standards and are delivering at a really good rate. So I'm baffled as to why Rupert Murdoch is doing something like this with National Geographic, and then he also owns and runs Fox News,
that and Fox Sports are the only things that. Or like still with that Fox name, if I'm remembering correctly, after the Disney kind of assumption
right.
of a lot of things. So yeah,
right.
Well, hasn't he stepped away from a lot of the media empire, and now his sons are running things?
That is what I've heard as well. And so I don't know of you know Rupert Murdoch's necessarily like involvement in that, and it may be that you know due to whatever. You know, powers are changing hands. Like they're not, you know, messing with National Geographic as much as they could be.
No.
You know, internally, politically, I don't know. Politically, that's real good. Not a thing. Not a thing, by the way, saying words that way.
Politics is tickly.
Yeah. but I agree too. I mean, I've picked up a couple issues of National Geographic recently. I used to be a you know forever subscriber. I had the magazines like lined up on a shelf for years until I decided why and they were all digital anyway, so that helped for a lot of the issues. But I think you're right. It does not seem like it's been the format has been messed with too much, so I think it is hopeful to see that there's it still exists, because I think as a source of information brand, it's still, you know, really well respected. And I think this only strengthens that.
And you're going to have this kind of thing when you have a publication that's been around that long. As society changes and what we find acceptable, like you're going to look back and say, oh, that doesn't look good. Like even just last night, I was listening to audiobook version of Sherlock Holmes with Stephen Fry reading it.
Oh, nice.
They're great. But I was laying in bed going to sleep, and it was really nice listening to the story. And then they started talking about phrenology and the difference
between
Eskimos and Negroes.
Yes.
And I was like, what the fuck? That's not...
Yeah. Phrenology as a, you know, in and of itself is sort of interesting, like the idea that your brain and your skull could be, you know, built in this way and they can map things based on that. I mean, it was all observational. And so from that point of view, it was kind of a cool thing, but wrong ultimately, but observationally
totally
interesting. And then the only thing that got, or not the only thing, but the bigger thing that came out of it was extrapolating, because if we can measure things and then compare things, we can make generalizations about race and how their brains work. And it's like,
no!
Nope.
No, but I mean, this dives into a whole different interesting conversation about old works of culture and art and how, when reintroducing them in today's setting, to what degree should you keep them in their original shape and to what degree should you update them a little bit. And I know in Norway there's been a lot of updating or a lot of discussions about especially children's stories written in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, where they talk about especially Africans in not necessarily derogatory ways, but just ways that are not kosher anymore, to use another topical term. And I know Pippi Longstocking, for example, she in those stories, she uses some expressions that I would not necessarily introduce to my 8-year-old these days. When I grew up, we read those stories that way, and now they're anyhow. So there's like discussions of how you should modernize and update them to fit into the situation today.
Wasn't there a version of Huck Finn where they renamed him Robot Jim?
I know there was. Right. I think you're right. I'm almost completely sure that that is a thing. I'll have to look that up.
There's actually a really funny bit in Jean-Claude Van Johnson.
Yeah.
Where they're doing Huck Finn.
Yep.
He's like, no, I'm just going to call him Jim. He's like, no, that doesn't work. So they cast an Asian guy.
Yeah.
Jim, because he didn't want to be racist. Just like really caricatured Asian guy.
Yeah, I know. I've suggested we read Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn in our family here because I don't remember it. And every time I suggest that, my wife says, like, no, we're going to hold off a little bit on that.
Yeah, that's a really interesting kind of topic, too. It's like, because as literature or as art, you know, when is it okay to kind of change those things or not, right? I mean, I'm sure, you know, the next thing or the first thing that popped into my head as soon as you said that was like, oh, like how E.T., they don't have guns anymore. It's flashlights.
That's stupid.
I think, and then it comes back to that, you know, if that's Spielberg's like decision to do that, is that cool because it's his work? And then we just go to, you know, Han shot first is really what it comes down to. But I think it's it does make things very, very interesting about like when is the thing put out into the world done?
Yeah. Yeah.
And no, do we hold everything to the current standard?
Yeah.
And does that devoid that piece of art of all value because it no longer fits with what is culturally acceptable?
And how does this relate to updating things like talking about the need for a well-regulated militia? Different story. Fine,
Are we going? Topic. Are we going that way?
No, but it's go back to the original thing about National Geographic and News Corps and everything. It was just baffling to me that they would let one of their organizations do something like that, while at the same time, one of their other outlets, Fox News, is basically dictating and teasing the American president into nuclear war and constitutional crisis, and the same owners are not seeing their responsibility in that light.
I think it makes a lot of sense because they have a diverse group of holdings that allow them to tap into different markets because the only thing they really care about is money.
Exactly. So it makes
you
it
can say whatever you want to Fox News. And then if you changed National Geographic to sound like Fox News, people would stop buying it.
Of course. So to me, it's just, it makes it even more cynical. It gave me a bitter taste in my mouth to acknowledge that, it's a nice thing to do, but I don't think you're doing it for the right reasons.
Hmm. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably true. Well, hopefully the reasons are or at least above board for our next kind of topic. This one is it pulls together a bunch of things from a bunch of different angles that we've talked about on the show previously. There's a company that's, I believe, from the Bay Area called Kitty Hawk. Kitty Hawk being a reference to the famous flight by the Wright
Amelia
brothers.
Amelia
Oh,
yeah.
No?
No, you're right. You're right.
It's Wright Brothers.
Wright Brothers.
My bad.
Yeah.
Kitty Hawk, North Carolina.
Right. But so it's a company that makes things that fly. The one that they're debuting is the Cora, and they're debuting it in New Zealand because they've entered into a partnership with the New Zealand government in order to play with like different technology and different ideas. And this one is to make an air taxi service. So the air taxi that they have built is, I think it has, it's maybe it holds two or four people. It's hard to tell by the size of the thing, but it's a small, small little thing. It's meant for like 60-mile trips. So it's not quite big enough to go intercity in New Zealand unless it's like in within a metropolitan area, but it does interestingly take off and land completely vertically. So they have 12 rotors that will push it off the ground, get it up into the air, and then they have a couple turboprops that can, you know, push it back and forth. So it uses those 12 rotors to stay up in the air, and then the main rotors to, you know, get it to and from places. And then the really interesting things are, one, it's completely electric, so it's all based on batteries, and it can still go about 60 miles of airtime. And then the other big thing is that it is meant to be autonomous, so no pilot, no human pilot at all. So it is just point-to-point air taxi service, and it looks like it's I almost said getting off the ground. I'm not going to say that.
And yet,
yes,
their dreams are taking flight.
Right. They're partnering with the New Zealand government to get started, and I think it's really interesting. Right, we've talked a lot about autonomous vehicles, but primarily on the ground, and how that's definitely a thing from a driving point of view. How do you feel about it flying?
Sure, why not?
All right, next thing.
And next topic, all right.
Okay. I mean, is there any disagreement there? I mean,
I think it, I mean, so in the article that I read, they mentioned that it's good for 60 miles. I think that's probably okay. But because it only holds like two or four people, I feel like you would have to have more of them to make an impact on traffic on a distance that short.
Oh, you would need a ton of them.
Yeah. And so then it turns into, do they all talk to each other, or are
they would have, they would have to, right?
You know,
you'd need automatic air traffic control.
That
stuff
implies standards, I think.
Yeah.
Which is why they're doing this in New Zealand.
Right.
So I think
probably a good idea.
I agree with you that like they should all talk to each other, but does that mean they're all going to be the same companies, or are they all going to be different companies? Like, are we building a monopoly?
Well, this is where it's a good thing that our policymakers are focused on the future and not taking it back to the 50s, because they would totally lay out a good plan and strategic developments here to ensure policies that make the best of this opportunity.
I can't tell when he's being sarcastic or not. I think it's the Norwegian. I'm not sure.
just go with most of the time.
I think this could, it makes sense that they would test this in a place like New Zealand, because geographically compared to the US, it's much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
There's less people. So there's going to be, you don't have to necessarily figure out, is this going to work for 300 million people? You know, it's a smaller scale, and see if it's viable.
Yeah, the article mentions, like, because the range is sort of short, they say, oh, it's like the distance between San Francisco and San Jose, which I am intimately familiar with. And I think if there were an option where I could fly from point to point between San Francisco and San Jose, that would be really cool. I'm not sure I want everyone else that is currently on the roads doing that too. I think that would make it, I think it's just a recipe for things to go really badly. But but that's because I think the idea of kind of having this as a thing that is thought through and regulated does not connect. Like, that is not their intention when things start out in the Bay Area, I feel.
Yeah, I don't think it would adapt well to somewhere like the Bay Area.
No. I think that's probably the reason they've gone to... I mean, they need it to be functioning at scale before they introduce it into a place like this.
And here that may not be viable with, I mean,
no,
with the air hubs that already exist between San Jose, Oakland, and San Francisco.
Santa Rosa. Like,
and Santa Rosa. I just don't think it would be a thing that would work here, but I don't think that means that it shouldn't be a thing that exists or works in other places.
The video of it taking off is pretty awesome. I mean,
that's super cool.
They're 12 and rotors. It's ridiculous.
But I mean, if they got something like that to function frequently, for example, between the Santa Rosa Airport and, I don't know, like Chrissy Field in San Francisco, then you would solve a lot of the commute challenges with the Novato. Because I mean, the problem between Santa Rosa and San Francisco is the Novato tightening that goes through Marin, where none of the landowners want to sell, and Marin doesn't see this as their problem, so they don't want to buy the land to widen the road.
Mm-hmm.
So you're down to like two lanes for a lot of that distance. But to do something like that would mean that people could live up here in Sonoma County and work in the city and not have to spend an hour and a half in a car each way every day.
Well, the other thing is, I don't think this is a replacement for mass transit or for commuting necessarily. Like, how many people take a taxi from here to San Francisco? Like, people either drive their own vehicle or take public transit. I could see this useful in a situation of, like, in Santa Rosa. It's a good example because I live here. If you had these going out there, you could have landing sites at wineries. Like, you could use this for wine tours. You could use this for tourist ventures rather than commuter ventures.
Yeah.
Ooh, that actually sounds really good, because then no one's driving.
Exactly.
Right.
Okay. I think it is a better angle in the Bay Area. I think as saturated as the commute would be, I think solving for that with air travel.
That's a terrible idea.
Yeah. But as a just like point to point thing, for a kind of a more occasional use, that makes a lot of sense. Plus, it gets those drunk drivers off the road.
Exactly.
True.
And into the air. No, wait.
Yeah.
We have been promised flying cars.
Well, we'll find out in New Zealand and not here, thankfully. It is really, really interesting, and we'll link the video for that, I'm sure. But kind of moving from air all the way to space. Our next story is something that Jürgen found earlier in the week. And how is that story?
It was interesting because when I first told you guys about it, I fell into the trap set by today's way of consuming media, because the story that broke was, after a year in space, astronaut Scott Kelly no longer has the same DNA as the identical twin. So I read that and I went, what? Like almost everyone else. And of course, this spread like wildfire, and everyone, because it's a fascinating headline that holds very little connection to the truth, which is often the best kind. So, if I understand it correctly, what it is that Scott and Mark Kelly, the identical twins, who are both astronauts, so their parents did something right. one of them has been spent a year up at the ISS space station, and they measured and studied and examined the twins' DNA before he did that. And then they did it in detail after he got back down. And what they found was that even after 6 months, after that, after he'd been back on the ground for 6 months, they observed a change in his gene expression, which is how your body reacts to your environment. So it's not that his DNA changed, but it's that the way that the genes express themselves, which still makes no sense to me. So, I mean, it was something that that Outlets just like went with. Because, I mean, if his DNA changed by 7%, he would be a different species. He would come down. He would come down to Earth as an alien. But it was fascinating how people were just like, yeah, that's a story, and like click and reply and share, and Outlets wrote about it. It was like everywhere for a while.
It has a number of elements that I think, from a like, oh, I get it kind of perspective, work. I mean, the big kind of things from it were the idea that they're twins, and one could be thought of as a control, the one that stayed on Earth, and then the one that went into space. And then there's the, you know, so that's definitely part of it. And there have been twin studies. That's a common thing that that is done in order to have that kind of like this idea of a control and an experiment kind of discussion, but with people. And then the other side of it is that everyone knows from seeing that documentary, the Fantastic Four, that exposure to space and cosmic rays like can change you and can mutate you. And so the headline that I saw, which I don't, it was pretty close to the one that you originally sent, was like, 7% of DNA changed from after a year in space. And I think we're just understanding enough of all of those things, and it echoes enough of what we've heard in other places, that it's like, oh, okay, so the credibility comes from there being a control, and then this confirms, the Fantastic Four, of course, this makes perfect sense.
Yes.
But I think it's just like anything else. You have to read the article, especially the source article, which is not an easily readable thing, right? It's these like papers that are often behind paywalls and things like that for various reasons about scientific papers. And
so boring.
And that's the thing, is that the actual like kind of examination of things is frankly kind of boring, because it's not meant to be super like explosive, because you're only changing like one variable at a time, right? If you remember the scientific method, that's what you do. And so the thing that I thought was the biggest bit of it, I mean, the gene expression thing, and I can explain that if you are lost, but the big thing for me was the idea that, one person can be a control. But if you're looking at mutations based on different things in space and whatnot, they're mutations that happen even just from being on Earth. So there is some understanding of like whatever the genetic drift would be in twins, even if they're both on Earth, because if they don't live like in the same house and do all the exact same things, they're going to have kind of variations about what they eat and what they experience and what other things affect their kind of body. The thing that is difficult about that gene expression is not that those genes were turned, they're different. It's just that they weren't necessarily on. And that's the idea that your body doesn't turn on those genes all at once. I'm sorry. Did I hear? Are we getting a feedback thing right now?
I'm sorry. That was.
But yeah, the short form is that like the whole like you're adapting to adapting to exercise. That's the big one, is like if you don't run, then your lungs aren't ready for running. Your heart isn't ready for running. But if you run for like a year every day, then by the end of that year, your gene expression with regards to cardiac output and lung output and stuff like that goes up. That doesn't mean your DNA has changed. It just means that expression is occurring. And so right. That's what they're saying.
That is actually the best. That's the best explanation I've seen so far. My favorite part of this was how these NASA scientists, they put out this press release, and it was very dry and everything. And then this thing just exploded as journalists caught on to that one poor phrasing, and it went everywhere. And they're like, no, that's not what we meant. No. They just saw this misunderstanding spread like wildfire on the internet.
And I think that harkens back to another thing that we've talked about with how, you know, the engagement matters, right? And if everyone saw that and clicked on it, then, you know, that's to their advantage to kind of vaguely state something and pop up their numbers. I mean, not that I'm saying that NASA was trying to increase their numbers for things. I mean, it is an interesting enough kind of thing, but it did get more, it certainly got more kind of national attention than I would think a normal NASA press release would.
Yeah. Now, speaking of twins, did I dream that Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed up for Triplets, a movie called Triplets?
That doesn't surprise me.
I suddenly have this that I saw something like that, and anyhow, with Danny DeVito, of course.
Of course.
And, you know, probably Seth Rogen or something like that. Anyhow.
That other fascinating twin study movie that, yeah. The twins and Fantastic Four are your spirit guides for this, this segment.
Excellent.
But, kind of speaking of movies and kind of moving over into spoiler territory, did both of you see this movie?
Yes.
Okay, I wanted to see it this week, and it ended up not going. So I will have to just kind of be the impartial observer for our discussion this week of Red Sparrow.
And we'll try not to spoil it too much for you, because it gets my recommendation. Go see it. Okay. What do you think, Jorgen?
I'm sorry. I just had to go in and check. And yes, there is a movie called Triplets. It is in pre-production. It will be directed by Ivan Reitman.
Oh my god! Oh.
It's written by Josh Gad and Ryan Dixon, and it stars Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito, and Eddie Murphy.
Interesting.
So there's something to live for. But Red Sparrow, yes, Red Sparrow. I believe I referred to it as Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Stripper. And I, having thought of it since, I totally stand by that description. I mean, I recommend it in the sense that there's a lot of action and there's a lot of nudity and there's some plot.
These are all checks in Jürgen's book, in other words.
These are all like ting, 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 yes. But I feel like it's and there's a lot of great cinematography, I thought, really cool visuals and stuff. But there it gets a little too twisty turny towards the end. In the sense that it's too many back and forth and back and forth trying to trick you as a viewer, I felt.
Okay.
And it's super derivative. Like, yes. It's like a John le Carre story or a Tom Clancy story. But I think the difference is that it's from the perspective of a Russian rather than a lot of those books by those authors always are from the American point of view,
sure,
or the mm-hmm. British point of view. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was interesting. But otherwise, absolutely. Like, I've seen these stories before. It's not anything I haven't really seen.
Mm-hmm. No. And the CIA guy here is not that competent.
No.
So I react to movies that when they elegantly screw with you, like I felt Sixth Sense is possibly the movie that has done that the best. spoiler alert. but when it's like so clearly trying to pull the rug out from under your feet so many times, and then it's like, but you're standing on yet another rug, type of thing, is then I don't like that so much.
I think it fooled me because I was not, I was giving it to the movie too much credit while I was watching it. Yes. Like the theory that I came up with halfway through the movie of what was happening was wrong, but I think would have been a better story.
Oh, okay.
So I was so like, oh yeah, this would make so much sense. And no, that's not what happens.
Huh. Yeah.
Oh, well now I have to see it in order to get that kind of experience. I did just recently rewatch Atomic Blonde, which has some similarities, at least in kind of, it's a strong female character. There's a lot of kind of fancy fighting. There is some nudity, Jürgen, if you'd like.
I've seen it. Okay. I've seen it.
And there is that aspect of like the towards the end of the movie, them being like, it's this way. No, it's this way.
Yeah.
And kind of losing its
way. I think this made more sense than Atomic Blonde did as far as the plot twists go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like it all kind of checks out. Well, I think also stylistically, Atomic Blonde is a lot more stylized than this. Like this was, had the realism thing going on. Like it's brutal, it's gritty. The sound design, there's a scene where somebody gets their leg broken and it was horrifying.
That effed me up. That was
like, there was a visceral, like physical response. Me and I saw it with Skylar, friend of the podcast, and we both shudders like, ah, I was clenched up, just like, oh god.
Is it better
and
or
I
worse?
Didn't see it coming.
Is it better or worse than the guy getting knifed in John Wick 2? And you know which one I'm talking about.
It's worse. Like there are multiple scenes that are graphically violent, that were actually impactful, which I respect that. Like it doesn't ever feel fun.
Okay, got it. I see what you mean.
And I think I would have enjoyed it if it had been half an hour shorter. It's 139 minutes long, and there's really no need for that.
Yeah.
There's no need for that. It could have easily been trimmed by at least half an hour and wouldn't have lost anything important.
Yeah, they could have taken a half hour out of the first act.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
That would have been fine. Really.
Well, that's good to know. I think I will, well, with any luck, I will watch that this week. So I'll round that kind of into the circle there. There's a bunch to catch.
We'll talk about it. Talk about it again in next week's episode.
Maybe. We'll see.
Yeah, it's one of those things that takes violence and nudity and things that you see in movies all the time and makes them feel more real. Okay. So you actually feel bad. Like it's not fun in any sense.
No, exactly.
Like there's no glorification of it. It's very like, no, this is real.
Huh. It's not fun nudity. It's not like old school. It's not
fun nudity.
No, there's nothing sexy about it.
Okay.
No, not at all. Hmm. It's Russian nudity.
Wow, don't go there. Don't go there. We're gonna before this goes completely off the rails, I wanted
It's a little late, Alan. It's a little late.
Well, in any case,
there were rails?
It's been no, you're right. You're probably right. We probably lost those rails like episode 3 or something.
I will say one last thing about Red Sparrow.
Uh-huh.
Francis Lawrence directed it. This might be his best movie since Constantine. Because he did I Am Legend, which is terrible.
Yes.
He did Water for Elephants, which is terrible. And he did 3 of the 4 Hunger Games movies, which were mediocre. So I think he's really stepped his game up.
Have a good warm place in my heart for Constantine, so that's nice. It's good to know that.
I don't.
Okay.
I don't. But I had really high hopes for I Am Legend. And I loved the first 10 minutes of I Am Legend, and then and then not so much more. I have an affinity for like post-apocalyptic zombie openings of movies where they have the empty cityscapes and all that stuff. I love that stuff.
He also was a director on a TV show called Kings, which was one of my favorites. One of those, like, it got canceled not even a full season in.
Right.
And it had an amazing cast and like great writers and this guy directing, and had so much potential that got ruined because it got canceled.
What was that about?
It was a like kind of retelling of the biblical story of King David. Ooh. In like this alternate United States in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And it had Ian McShane and Sebastian Stan and a few other people. Like it was I enjoyed it a lot.
Speaking of Ian McShane, have we talked about American Gods?
No, because I've not seen it yet.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's on my list. I know.
It's as it should be.
Hey, I can't judge. I just finished Westworld. So.
Oh my gosh. Okay. All right. We'll definitely be talking about those probably soon. Maybe eventually. Possibly even next show. If you would like to have any kind of input into our show, either the next one or any one of the ones coming up, feel free to tweet at us, Facebook us, hit us up in real life if you know who we are. I'm sure many of you do. So be on the show. We haven't had a guest in a while. I know that we wanted to do that more this year. So we may be reaching out to you, but if you really want to be on a show, reach out to us. Even if you only sort of want to be on a show, we're pretty flexible about working with different people to get on. Hopefully we can have that pretty soon. In the meantime, we're going to just wrap this one up, and then I will talk to you both in a couple weeks.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Until next time.
Bye now.